From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The SpaceX rocket headed for the International Space Station exploded just a couple of minutes into its ascent Sunday morning. It was the third resupply mission to fail in 8 months. But there's a heck of a lot more going on in space than just the space station. Best ever pictures of Pluto coming soon. Rover is gathering data on Mars. Space telescopes are finding lots of planets our size everywhere. And a lot of countries are getting into the game. It's no breeze, but it is real. This hour on Point, the world's space agenda. You can join us on air or online. Are we in a new race for space? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington is Jeff Faust, senior staff writer for Space News. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. A pleasure to be on.
Thanks for being here. SpaceX Falcon 9 breaks up right after launch on Sunday. What happened?
About 2 minutes and 20 seconds after liftoff Sunday morning, the rocket suffered some sort of malfunction with its upper stage. We don't know the details yet about specifically what happened. That's still under investigation, but we do know what resulted was that the rocket effectively exploded. It broke up and was unable to deliver its cargo spacecraft into orbit to provide supplies to the International Space Station.
So two previous resupply missions have failed. This one was considered to be critical. What now for equipment and experiments and, most importantly, supplies?
Well, fortunately, there's still plenty of food and water on the space station. They've got enough supplies to last until October, even if no other supply ship showed up. Fortunately, there's a couple more on its way. There's a Russian Progress spacecraft that'll launch early Friday. And in August, Japan will launch its own cargo spacecraft to the space station. So fortunately, they probably won't be running short on food and water on the space station, and they will be getting some more experiments to perform up there as well. They'll have to replace some of the hardware that was lost on this failure, of course. But fortunately, the situation isn't particularly dire for the space station right now.
What about some of the other projects beyond the International Space Station? The U.S. has this New Horizons probe that's approaching Pluto. Tell us about that. Are we expecting images soon?
There's already images coming back from the New Horizons spacecraft. It's 2 weeks out from its closest approach to Pluto. That'll be on the morning of July 14th. So we'll be getting better pictures each day as it approaches. And, of course, on the arrival day, we'll get some very sharp photos in the days and weeks to come after that close flyby. It's our first look at what used to be the ninth planet in the solar system and now is considered a dwarf planet, but still a very exciting world and our first close-up glimpse at it.
What about the Mars rover? It's still functioning, right? Still sending back information?
Right. Yeah, the Curiosity rover, in August, it'll be on Mars for 3 years, and it's still in very good shape. NASA has other spacecraft orbiting Mars right now, as well as another rover called Odyssey, which has been on Mars since 2004. So we have several spacecraft at Mars. We have another one called InSight. That'll be a lander that will launch next year to help probe the interior of Mars. So we've got a real fleet of spacecraft, and other nations have spacecraft at Mars as well.
We'll get to that in a minute, but let me hear President Obama here in his State of the Union address saying that the U.S. should still strive to win the space race and to land on Mars and to stay on Mars. In the process, we'd create new jobs, he says, and new technologies back here on Earth.
I want Americans to win the race for the kinds of discoveries that unleash new jobs. Converting sunlight into liquid fuel. Creating revolutionary prosthetics so that a veteran who gave his arms for his country can play catch with his kids again. Pushing out into the solar system. Not just to visit, but to stay.
What other countries are moving toward Mars? I know India's made an effort.
India has a spacecraft orbiting Mars. It arrived there last year. It was their first mission. It's been a very successful mission so far. Europe has a mission orbiting Mars for several years, called Mars Express. It's working on a joint program with Russia called ExoMars that'll include a spacecraft that'll launch into orbit in 2016 and a lander that will follow 2 years later. And China's talked about eventually doing Mars missions as well, probably several years in the future.
Here's billionaire entrepreneur Elon Musk telling CNN's Farhad Zakaria that landing on Mars is not enough, that staying there, colonizing, is actually his goal.
Apollo was an amazing, inspiring thing for all of humanity, but the last time we went to the moon was like 1973 or 4, I believe. So we don't want to just have flags and footprints. and then never go to Mars again. If we just have one mission, that will also be a super inspiring thing, but it's not going to fundamentally change the future of humanity.
Mm. What about U.S. efforts, Jeff Faust, to develop a new rocket and a Challenger passenger capsule for deep space travel? This is quite interesting.
NASA is currently working on a very large, heavy-lift rocket called the Space Launch System, or SLS. Its first flight is scheduled probably for some time in 2018. It's also developing a crewed spacecraft called Orion that performed an initial test flight without anybody on board late last year, did a couple of orbits of the Earth before splashing down in the Pacific. It will fly on that first SLS mission in 2018, and then will fly with the crew probably in 2021. Hmm. The initial missions will be in and around the moon, but eventually SLS and Orion will be the building blocks for NASA's plans to send humans to Mars in the 2030s.
Here's some sound of the countdown of the 2014 December launch of the still experimental Orion space capsule.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And liftoff at dawn. The dawn of Orion and a new era of American space exploration.
Sounds like a very active period in space exploration, not just here in the United States, but around the world. Is there more going on than perhaps we realize?
Well, more and more countries are getting involved with space. They are developing their own space programs, spacecraft in Earth orbit, and sometimes science missions beyond. One example is the United Arab Emirates, which is developing its own spacecraft to go to Mars in 2020. So you're seeing more nations taking that leap beyond Earth orbit into the solar system. Mm.
Jeff Faust, senior staff writer for Space News, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Since we're talking about the whole world's efforts to push out into space, we have a panel with international expertise. Let me bring in first Jeffrey Forden, who's with me from Albuquerque today. He's a physicist at Sandia National Laboratories, where he works on arms control and international security. He's a former principal research scientist at MIT, where he analyzed Russian and Chinese space systems. And it's that research that he did at MIT that we'll be speaking with him about today. Jeff, so good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. I'm very happy to be here with you.
Well, thank you. What are the big scientific pursuits that are out there from your perspective for space discovery internationally?
Well, I think that probing the outer solar system gives us a great deal of information about our planet on Earth. It's important for Earth scientists to test their theories against a whole bunch of different conditions. They can't really do an experiment on a planet-sized scale, so going out and visiting these other planets allows them to have different conditions that enable them to refine their understanding of how things happen here on Earth.
I understand that in the not-so-distant future, you anticipate a very sophisticated replacement of the Hubble telescope. Can you tell us about that?
So that's the Jack Webb telescope. It's going to be something like 6 meters in diameter. It'll be launched put into what's called a Lagrange point between the Earth and Sun, so that it stays in that position and trails the Earth and takes amazing photographs of deep sky objects.
And what do we use those photographs for? What do we use that information to do?
Well, Hubble telescope was an amazing breakthrough in our understanding of the universe. I mean, we actually saw stars being formed. We saw planets being formed. And we have a better understanding of just how many galaxies there are in the universe and how old the universe is because of Hubble. And such a large improvement in resolution, the ability to see smaller and smaller details of things in space, should open up new areas that we can understand basics physics of the universe.
What about future exploration of that outer solar system? We've talked about probes still making their way to the moon and Mars and Jupiter, heard about New Horizons. What might we learn when those probes land?
Well, most of the probes going into the outer solar system are going to orbit their targets, and you'll be able to study them for several years at a time and see how they change with the changing conditions there. So, for instance, there's an ice moon of Jupiter that can probably hold an ocean full of water underneath its icy surface, and how it manages to retain a liquid water way out there in the outer reaches of the solar system is very interesting, and hopefully we'll be able to determine how that happens.
Tell us about the Deep Space Network and why that's important.
The Deep Space Network of satellite observing telescopes.
Yes.
So it's important to have what's called space situational awareness from a security point of view, and more we can track satellites, the more we can track and make sure that they are obeying the rules of the road or a code of conduct for satellites around the Earth. And that will enable us to give warning to, say, like the manned space station to be able to move out of the way if a piece of space junk comes along.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about what humanity is up to in space. A big, embracing look at everything from our Earthward-looking satellites to our faraway probes and rovers to our plans for putting humans on other heavenly bodies. Here's some audio from August 2012 of the NASA team as they receive word that the Mars Curiosity rover successfully landed after the tense 7 minutes of terror, as it was known, that landing phase.
UHF is good. Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars. Time to see where our curiosity will take us.
You can join the conversation. Does it feel like a lot's happening to you? If you were calling the shots, which programs would you scrub? Which ones should go full steam ahead? A great lineup today. My guest, Jeff Forden, a physicist at Sandia National Laboratories and a former principal research scientist at MIT, where he analyzed Russian and Chinese space systems. Joining me now in the studio is Joan Johnson Fries, professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College. She is author of Heavenly Ambitions, America's Quest to Dominate Space, Space as a Strategic Asset, and The Chinese Space Program, A Mystery Within a Maze. Just to say, she is not speaking on behalf of the U.S. government today. Joan, so nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So the International Space Station was built by, 15 different countries under the leadership of space agencies in the United States, in Russia, Europe, Canada, and Japan. I'm curious, beyond that particular program, who is collaborating and who's competing in space right now?
Well, the International Space Station, sometimes you hear it called the International Family of Spacefaring Nations, and that's a euphemism for the space station because countries view that as very symbolic. If you are part of the space station, you are a space player. But there's other things going on as well. China has a very ambitious space program and is already inviting other countries to participate in their human spaceflight program.
Well, there's growing debate about whether China and the U.S. should actually cooperate in space. Is it in the U.S. interest to engage China in space?
In my opinion, it is. But since 2011, NASA has been legislatively banned from bilaterally working with China on space activity. So that doesn't really present us with an option.
So they're not collaborating at all right now?
Well, they're working on multilateral things like space debris through organizations, international organizations that deal with that issue. But in terms of working together to potentially go to the moon, go to Mars, no.
Chinese scientists are considering how they can put a massive space station into orbit, which in theory would supply, I guess, a constant stream of energy, solar energy to Earth. It's a big idea. Is it pie in the sky or is it actually doable?
Well, the Chinese have had a very ambitious and incremental human spaceflight program since 1992, which has had three parts. Part one was to prove space capabilities. Can they launch and have a human in space? Part two, where they're at now, is to demonstrate advanced space capabilities such as docking, spacewalks. And they have a small laboratory called Tiangong, which they will use to basically as a preliminary step towards a large 30-ton space station, which will culminate their program. So that's kind of their step one. But they also have a robotic lunar program, Chang'e, which is also well underway. And it's anticipated that probably within the next 5 years, they will combine those programs, if successful, towards a human lunar program. Mm.
Sounds ambitious, but as I'm reading here, the Chinese human spaceflight program is about equivalent to the U.S. program in the Gemini era 50 years ago. Is that fair?
The Chinese aren't doing anything that the United States hasn't done already many years ago. But what they are, what's happening is they're doing it now. And the perception is because they have a very active program where they are showing people going to space and going to the moon, there's a perception that they are potentially beating the United States in terms of space capabilities.
Let's get a caller in here, Brandon in Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Brandon. You're on a point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question regards some of the consequences, particularly looking forward from the SpaceX failure. So they were really in a pretty heated competition with United Launch Alliance versus the military satellites, as well as also in competition with a Boeing United Space Alliance CST-100 capsule to deliver astronauts to the space station. And in light of this SpaceX Falcon 9 recent failure, just wanted to see what some of your experts think could be the ramifications in the programs moving forward.
Mm. Thank you, Brandon, very much. Jeff Forden, what are the consequences to your mind of the SpaceX failure this last weekend?
Well, it's too early to know exactly what happened this weekend on their space launch vehicle. However, what we're seeing is a competition between two very different philosophies of getting something in space. SpaceX takes the philosophy that they can do much cheaper launches by cutting down on the number of tests they do, both on the ground and space flight tests, as well as the documentation that they keep of. And the reasoning behind this is that they make their rockets very simple. Hmm. Now, it's still an open question in my mind whether this will succeed. Obviously, the risks of not doing as much tests or as much documentation is that you might have failures. However, they've had 10 successful launches out of 11 attempts with their latest version of the Falcon 9, so which is a pretty good success rate. Hmm. So I think we're still in a pretty it still looks pretty good for that philosophy, though I have a certain amount of skepticism.
Hmm. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from Piscataway, New Jersey, Anatoly Zak, journalist, author, and space historian. He's editor of RussianSpaceWeb.com and author of Russia in Space, The Past Explained, The Future Explored. Welcome to you, Anatoly.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. We've talked about China a little bit and India. Where does Russia stand at this moment in the space race?
Well, Russia is obviously one of three countries which right now has full capability to fly humans in space. And in addition to China and the United States, it conducts very active human space flight program. And in fact, American astronauts right now for past few years actually riding Russian Soyuz spacecraft to the International Space Station, sort of highlight of this Russian active program. And, of course, they also built part of the International Space Station. Mm-hmm. They have active segment, Russian segment on board of the International Space Station. And they design number of new modules which will go in the next few years.
Mm. Johnson Fries, what about reports that the Pentagon and the U.S. intelligence communities are developing war plans and operation centers to fend off Russian and Chinese attacks on satellites, on military and government satellites in space?
Well, the government likes to talk in threes, and they describe the space environment as congested, contested, and competitive. And they see those three Cs as largely coming from China and Russia. Hmm. So the Pentagon has come up with a strategy which they call defend, deter, and defeat, which is moving from a prior policy, which can be described as strategic restraint, where we worked multilaterally, we used all tools of policy and technology to defend our space assets, to one now that's referred to as offensive counterspace, which is much more militaristic, much more reliant on technology, and in my opinion, much more apt to lead to misunderstanding, misinterpretation, and mistrust, to keep with the three the threesomes.
Anatoly Zak, do you agree with that?
Pretty much, yes. And Russia, in turn, itself also very actively developing military component to its space program. And in fact, recently, a number of Russian politicians and top officials in the space program, they said that military aspect of the program is much more important even than human spaceflight, which was traditionally sort of centerpiece of the Russian space program. Mm-hmm. So they very actively, they launching spy satellites, they building reportedly anti-satellite capability. They just launched totally new type of spacecraft, which apparently we still don't know what it is, but apparently it's Inspector slash satellite anti-satellite system. So they're very actively pursuing a military space program. Mm.
Jeff Forden, space was thought to be, you know, a virtual sanctuary, but it sounds like that's changing. Is it realistic to think that there might someday be conflicts that extend into space?
Well, the countries that Joan talked about, China and India, both have very active programs to put up sensors that would be related to their military in space. I just spent a very interesting week with a retired Indian general who made it very clear that India has plans on putting up what are called early warning satellites as well as military observation satellites as force multipliers. So in some sense, the conflict is already starting. Mm. I think all countries would benefit by not having anti-satellite weapons. And so I'm hoping that there will be some sort of agreement to that effect.
Do you see that happening, Joan Johnson-Fries?
Not with this current turn towards this more offensive counterspace, which we saw very heavily 10 years ago, but the Obama administration moved from that and is now moving back. I think it's important to point out that space technology, most space technology, is dual use, meaning that it has value to both the civilian and the military communities. So we largely know what countries are doing in space, but we don't know why. Hmm. And that leads to a lot of ambiguity. So while some countries see, for example, our missile defense program as having potential offensive capabilities, that leads to threat perceptions.
Questions. A lot of question marks. Sabian is calling from Woodbridge, Virginia. Sabian, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have a comment and a question. I just want to say, first off, I find this topic interesting because last night I was talking to my girlfriend, actually, about going to Mars. We were talking about, you know, all the plans and stuff that are happening for Mars exploration. And my comment is, I wrote a thesis in my university on terraforming of Mars. I know about the Mars One plan. I think Lockheed Martin, Martian kind of real estate advertisement, it seemed like.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about the conflicts, my first thought is that humanity should not begin colonizing space until we figure out our solution, you know, at least be able to work amongst all the nations here on the planet first. And the thesis that I wrote, and I think that would help us get to this point, I know that there's certain plans for terraforming Mars right now, but those plans call for like a 500-year process. And my thesis that I wrote is called the Mars Hemp Project. I'm the owner of the Virginia Hemp Company, mm-hmm. and we start university research actually tomorrow. Our governor signed our industrial university research hemp bill. And part of our research is going to see how well hemp grows on Mars because the way that the hemp plant grows compared to other plants that are being suggested to take to the terraforming of the planet, it grows a lot faster, and it'll oxygenate the planet a lot sooner than, you know, some...
Than might happen otherwise. Sabian, thank you. Joan Johnson-Fries, what do you say to that sort of an experiment on Mars?
Well, you know, there's lots of very interesting ideas. Terraforming Mars, you hear about going to the moon to mine for helium-3. But those are all... those are all dependent on first getting there. I mean, we first have to have the technology to get there, to be there. In the case of helium-3, we don't have a reactor to use it in. So all of these are visionary.
As NASA's Mars rover approached its destination, NASA put out this video explaining the incredibly complex landing that was going to happen. So here's engineer Tom Ravelli explaining all the elements that needed to work perfectly in order for this $2.5 billion mission to succeed, and succeed it did.
Entry, descent, and landing, also known as EDL, is referred to as the 7 minutes of terror, because we've got literally 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere to the surface of Mars, going from 13,000 miles an hour to zero, in perfect sequence, perfect choreography, perfect timing, and the computer has to do it all by itself with no help from the ground. If any one thing doesn't work just right, it's game over.
Jeff Forden, I mean, these are big price tags, $2.5 billion mission. It's a big mission. It's a big operation. Are the yields equally big on the other side?
Oh, I think so. With our exploration of Mars, I mean, it's an amazing discovery to say that there's been water on that planet. Exactly how much water was up there and what form it was in, those are very interesting.
Eric is in Miami, Florida. Hi, Eric. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment about, actually someone else made a comment about the about terraforming on Mars and that being more of a visionary idea. But what I would have to say is the way things are going now on Earth with climate change, it seems as though there are plans for a better sustainability, like things that Obama has said that we're going to try and make a change. But with the way things are going with climate change and how extreme the weather is becoming and how much time it seems we have to make an actual change where things don't keep getting worse, I guess the question is, does anyone see a future with actually terraforming or moving operations to another planet?
Yeah, you're talking about an alternative living space. Joan Johnson-Fries, what about that?
Well, I don't disagree with anything that's been said about the desirability of doing it. But the problem is these kind of missions are still so big that they are largely funded by governments. Mm-hmm. And public perception, public attitudes, even at the end of the Apollo era, was that space is a desirable thing to do. It's a good thing to do, but it's expendable when it comes to public spending. It's something that people think is a good thing, but if it's a choice between space exploration and development or roads, education, defense, it doesn't rank especially high.
So we want to own the space race, but we don't necessarily want to pay for it.
Exactly.
So what about NASA's efforts to commercialize some of this with people like Elon Musk and others, Jeff Forden? How do you see that going? Are they succeeding?
Well, I think it's NASA's responsibility to find the cheapest way of accomplishing its mission. So, well, again, with SpaceX, we'll have to see how that design philosophy works out.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about what the U.S. and other countries are doing right now in space and what's on the drawing board and whether this will be a space race between nations or whether we'll all work together. My guest this hour, Joan Johnson-Fries, professor of international security studies at the U.S. Naval War College. Anatoly Zak, journalist, space historian, and author of the book Russia in Space, and editor of RussianSpaceWeb.com. And Jeff Forden, a physicist at Sandia National Laboratories and a former principal research scientist at MIT. Well, India took a big, important step deeper into the space race when it sent a probe into Mars. Here is the sound from the liftoff of India's satellite launch in November 2013.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, plus 1, 2, 3,
Liftoff
normal.
Prakshepan safaltaya.
Ratri tracking.
Very fantastic.
And here's India's Prime Minister celebrating his country's mission to launch that satellite to orbit Mars.
History has been created today. We have dared to reach out into the unknown and have achieved the near impossible.
So India is very much in the mix, Anatoly Zak. India was the first Asian country to reach Mars, the first country to orbit Mars on its first attempt, got there in record time on a shoestring budget. Talk about the geopolitics of some of this race exploration.
Well, I think for many of those countries, entering space race is exactly what it was in the 60s for the United States and Russia. It's a issue of status. They demonstrating their scientific capabilities, economic and technical capabilities. So there is a political, very strong political dimension beside pure scientific goals, which very often not really driving this mission. It's politics and nationalism, which is very often behind those missions. And India and China is probably not exception, especially China, probably.
What about India in the space race, Joan?
I agree completely with Anatoly that India saw the prestige, the geopolitical status that China has been reaping as a result of its successful space program, and was feeling and looking like kind of an also-ran in an Asian space race, and felt compelled to try and catch up, and did so by getting into the record books ahead of China in terms of Mars.
Yes.
And again, the technology being used is all dual use, which feeds very well into their military space ambitions. And overall, there's as much an Asian space race going on as there was between the U.S. and Russia in the 60s.
Jeff Forden, India not only caught up, but they ran right past a lot of countries that were in the way.
They certainly have a very active program and have accomplished a tremendous amount.
Let's get to Sabia in Braintree, Massachusetts. Hi, Sabi. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Basically, this is much more in the vicinity of hopes, as I think it's very wonderful that, you know, humans have the natural actions of competing with each other. But I think, you know, looking into the observable universe and sort of that, you know, vastness, when it comes to humanity, I really feel like that, you know, for us, the border stops at Earth, and we're really looking outside of this, you know, pale blue dot. And I just really have a hope for humanity that they can really come together, because this is quite a big task to tackle, and we are very small in this sense. So I really feel that it's great for having a race. However, when it comes to, you know, habitable planets and perhaps the future of humanity in, you know, way ahead in time, I really feel the need to be together. And I think that is the only way really we're going to progress even more once we understand to be together is how we can tackle.
Sabi, thank you so much. We've got to work together is what I hear this caller say.
Oh, it's interesting. The astronauts call this the overview effect, that going into space and seeing the Earth as a planet totally dependent, everyone dependent on each other. They see this as very important, and many of them come back and make it their task to kind of support this view that the caller was talking about, astronaut Ron Guerin, for one, has been saying space should be something that unites us to work together. And again, as the prior caller talked about with climate change, we may have to move faster than the politicians want to.
Jeff Forden, I have a very practical question. With so many countries and companies jumping into space right now, who's directing traffic up there? What are the rules of the road in space?
Well, that's a very good question. And it turns out that there are some rules of the road that they have no obvious enforcement mechanism. There's the International Telegraphic Union, which is a historical name, but it regulates the numbers and positions of satellites in certainly geostationary orbit. There's another movement some countries in Europe and the United States are trying to pursue. It's called a Code of Conduct for Spacefaring Nations. And it advocates very practical measures to make sure that space debris isn't created accidentally or certainly not on purpose.
Here's Eric in Niagara Falls, New York. Hi, Eric. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
We can't reasonably... Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
We can't reasonably go into space and explore all these vast distances without first cleaning up our own neighborhood. So I agree that the debris around the Earth needs to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. And I have a real simple solution for it. If we had a fleet of spacecraft that all they had to do is get up there and put out a great deal of water vapor and or air right in front of an object, slow it down with friction so gravity can do the rest, and at the same time this expulsion of water vapor and air would then propel this interceptor to the next object where it would then again expel water vapor and air, creating friction right in front of another object. And the water vapor and air doesn't, of course, hurt anybody.
You sound like a physicist, Eric. Let's put that to our panel here. But to the bigger question of debris, Joan Johnson-Freeze, I mean, it's a big issue.
Well, as the caller suggested, there are ways to deal with it. But who owns this fleet of spacecraft that would go up and do this? Who pays for it? Is it international? That means we work together. We've already talked about the political issues of working together. But I agree, sustainability of the space environment is critical if we're to be able to use space for all the military and civilian applications, which we have come to depend upon so much. There is an active group that works on space debris, and there has actually been international consensus that something needs to be done, and they have made suggestions as to what. The problem is that implementation then gets turned over to governments, and that's where politics comes in.
Anatoly Zak, I'm reading about Google planning to put 4,000 satellites in space to improve all sorts of services. I mean, what if other companies do it too? Amazon, Facebook. I mean, that's a lot of orbits, a lot of satellites orbiting Earth. Can it get too crowded up there?
Yes, there is a lot of experts. Experts actually disagree on this issue. Very often when we place, we have to remember not to kind of over-exaggerate this problem. Because very often when we place those low orbital satellites, which are normally in, let's say, 200 from 200 to 300 kilometers above Earth, they exist there for a very short period of time, and then they eventually they slow down, their orbits decay, and they fall into Earth's atmosphere and burn up. So space has this ability to clean itself. However, this happens at the lower orbit. If we launch satellites to the higher orbits, then of course it takes much longer for the satellites to decay and fall back to Earth.
Jeff Jordan, do you agree with that? I mean, is space cleaning itself?
I agree exactly what Anatoly said. He's hit the button on the nose when he says that it's low Earth satellites don't last very long in orbit if they're not constantly boosting themselves up. Unfortunately, the problem isn't just confined to satellites. There's a wide range of debris, ranging from paint chips to nuts and bolts to, you know, half of a rocket body, and they are at varying altitudes. And so if you have a satellite or a rocket body that was the third stage to a geostationary satellite, which is taking it out to a very large radius, and that rocket body explodes after it's, you know, been sitting in space for a couple of years unattended, then you're creating very long-lasting debris that goes right up into the orbits of some very sensitive satellites.
Let's get Richard on the line here. He's in Sherman, Connecticut. Hi, Richard. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I want to say that space is the biggest boondoggle in the history of the United States. It is ridiculous to be talking or wasting money on going to Mars. So what if we put a man on Mars? It has no value whatsoever. NASA ought to be concentrating on just putting satellites up and spending much of its budget on climate change.
Richard, I've been waiting for your call. Joan Johnson Freeze, there are a lot of people out there who think this very thing.
Well, again, I would first of all disagree with the boondoggle part that GPS is one of two global utilities. So I think right there we can dispel with that. But the idea of human spaceflight, and exploration generally, we've learned a great deal about our own planet and climate change from exploration. We have, in fact, developed technology for human spaceflight that has had spinoffs on Earth that we now it's such a part of our culture we don't even remember that it came from space. So I think there's a leadership implication, too, that we need to think about, that space has connotations with regard to the future. It always has. The countries that go into space are the countries that are leading into the future. So I don't think we can write off the dimension of human spaceflight. And there's an adage, you don't throw parades for robots. You throw parades for humans.
Maya is in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Maya. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'll make it quick. My dad was on the program for the first European Space Lab in 73. And as a teenager, I marveled watching him as a liaison with 13 countries working on this project. And the thing that I saw the most was the international support. It was so interesting to hear his stories about the input from the different countries and the benefits from it sociologically, scientifically, and obviously observationally. And it's turned into, you know, the sustainability of what we have now. It was a very exciting time to see that this all happened without emails and faxes. How did they make that happen?
In a different time. Maya, thank you very much. I wanted to ask you, Joan, about the difference between militarization and weaponization in space.
Well, you sometimes hear journalists talk about a fear that space will be militarized. And I think it needs to be made clear that militarization has occurred since before NASA, when we were using any kind of rocket, that militarized space. The Rubicon that we haven't crossed is into weaponization. And as Jeff talked about before, this is something I think a lot of people are very concerned about, that we would move to programs that could potentially kinetic impact in space, creates more debris, creates more threats. That we want, I think there are a lot of us hoping that through a code of conduct, through rules of the road, through confidence-building measures, we can avoid this move to weaponization. Part of the problem, though, is defining just what that means. Mm.
Anatoly Zak, do you see a time when space satellites and space stations become military targets?
Well, in fact, they probably already are. And what I wanted also to point out is that to militarize space, we don't really need – very often it's perceived as we've imagined the satellites with platforms carrying missiles and so on. But in fact, very often anti-satellite weapons, for example, they can be deployed in silos on the ground. And in fact, we have some understanding that, for example, China just recently tested a missile which was launched from the ground and destroyed the satellite in space. Same the United States. They launched a missile from the Navy destroyer. So essentially, space is already militarized. It's just that the weapons which destroy other satellites and have capability to do pretty much turn space into battlefields, they're just deployed on Earth, and they're already there.
Mm. Jeff Forden, just about a minute or so left here, but pie in the sky, take us beyond the horizon. What do you see in space in the next 5-10 years?
Well, on such a short time frame, I think we'll continue to explore with robotic missions, which I think are economically viable, and we'll continue to develop the necessary infrastructure. I'm talking about the United States in particular, to remain in low Earth orbit and prepare ourselves for moving on. Hmm.
Joan Johnson-Freeze, what do you see out there?
Well, as a political scientist, I'm looking for political will. I'm looking for political will for international cooperation and for using all policy tools to deal with keeping space a sustainable environment. Mm.
Anatoly Zak, you get the final word in our 10 seconds left here.
Well, I also hope, I want to echo this, and I just hope that our political relations on Earth will not ruin our cooperation in space. Mm.
Anatoly Zak, journalist, space historian, and author of the book Russia in Space. Thank you so much, Anatoly.
Thank you.
Jeff Forden, Sandia National Laboratories, former researcher at MIT. Jeff, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
And Joan Johnson-Freeze here in the studio with me, professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College. So great to have you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.